Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. Sign up to be a paid member and get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and exclusive bonus episodes that we make just for members. Thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com who makes this podcast possible.
What do you call this miracle orb?
In our tongue, grey glitter. In yours, something like Mithraud.
No, it would be Mithril.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, covering the Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. I am David Chen.
And I'm Don Marshall.
This episode, we're going to be discussing Season 1, Episode 4 of The Rings of Power, entitled The Great Wave. We are going to spoil everything through this week's episode, but we will not spoil anything from future weeks, and that includes anything on the next time on preview or anything from the books. You can always find more episodes of this show in podcast form at podcast.decodingtv.com or find us on YouTube at youtube.com/decodingtv. Don Marshall, I wanted to talk to you as a follow-up about something that we have discussed in previous weeks, and that is the opening credits sequence.
Okay.
We have speculated about what the opening credits sequence meant, what they were about, what they were trying to accomplish. Variety this week published an article entitled Inside the Secrets of the Rings of Power Title Sequence. And so there's apparently a group or an agency called Planes of Yonder that put together the opening sequence. And a lot of it was apparently done practically.
Really?
One of the people named Katrina Crawford discusses the creation of the opening title sequence. She has a PhD in molecular biology and, quote, discovered beautiful combinations when she spread sand out on a tray and paired it with the sound of Gregorian chants. So she filmed the effect on her iPhone, and they continued to experiment with different materials like fungal powder to pigments to learn more about the behavior of different particle sizes and density, as well as how to control the process. So I'm going to quote here. When the time came for the actual filming, they paired sand of varying particle sizes with a single hertz tone from a computer tone generator. Every frame of the title utilizes this technique, and many frames would later be enhanced or cleaned up with CGI to achieve a finished product that represents a world created through song. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. The title sequence is not all random. In addition to diamonds and swirls, there are mountains, trees, islands, and continents, and there are rings. 9 in one frame, 3 in another. Numbers played an important role in Tolkien's work, and Crawford and Bashore wanted to honor this while hinting at events set within and beyond the Second Age in which Rings of Power is set. End quote. So anyway, I thought you'd appreciate that little tidbit about
that. Is nice
how it's made. Yeah.
I love that. And you know what? This is starting to feel a little bit like the behind the scenes stuff from the movies. I'm getting the same vibe from this TV show. Every week, something new comes out that I didn't know about. And it's like, ooh, that's a nice little behind the scenes tidbit. I love it.
Yeah, I think they're doing the PR really well. They obviously spread it out and timed it so that there'd be like new pieces of information coming out as the movie. I'm sorry, as the show is released each week.
Right.
One other detail I thought I would read. She says, quote, Crawford in the article writes, quote, "We have the 9 rings for men, the 7 for the dwarves, the 3 rings for the elves, and a single ring. All those combinations are through there, and they're at the beginning and the end. We start with those, and they're building other things, and then we end with them. We thought it was cool that a sequence could end as it began, totally in lockstep with the Tolkien universe of things coming and going across millennia, that if you began with something as abstract as that and ended as dust, it would create the sense of an endless cycle," end quote. So,
Ooh. So
Don Marshall, not just vibes after all for the opening title sequence, huh?
No, but in fact, almost entirely vibes in the vibrations causing the...
You got me.
I tried. I love learning little stuff like that. That is so cool to like I'm glad that there was a lot of thought and effort put into it, and not just we wanted to try something different for the sake of being like, there's a lot of intention behind it. So that's very cool to see. I like that.
Indeed. All right, Don Marshall, let's talk about episode 4 of season 1 of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, The Great Wave. We'll start with overall thoughts. What did you think of this episode, Don?
I think this was the best episode we've seen so far. And that has been more or less true with every episode. There were a few moments in 3 I didn't like, but 4 really seemed like they're ramping it up. We got a bunch of amazing lore drops that me as a book reader just, is it a little fan service-y? Yeah, but I think it was handled in such a way that like, it was really used well. I liked the writing in this one, especially Elrond. We'll get to him. There were a few moments that stood out to me that I wasn't crazy about, that I think were a little too on the nose. I think you and I might be thinking the same thing. Mm-hmm. But I think, yeah, overall, they're on the right track here, it seems to me.
I thought it was pretty good. I think that here's what I like about the show. When Game of Thrones was in its earlier days and skipping around to different plot lines, it often would feel perfunctory, like sometimes visiting one of these locations
mm-hmm.
in an episode. And I like that they are, rather than making sure we visit every single character, you know, there's sometimes they're skipping characters and being like, right. Let's focus more on this character. And right. I think that's like a good tendency that they have. Like they're giving each of these storylines a little bit of room to breathe.
Right? Yeah. And because we didn't even see the Harfoots this episode. They were, and we didn't see, what was it? Is it Elrond and Durin? I think we didn't see any of Moria in week 3.
Correct. I was like, yeah, no, we definitely saw them this week though.
But yeah. Yes. No, they were the highlight this week.
Yeah. I agree. I would agree. I think the Elrond and Durin stuff is some of the more interesting material in the show and continues to be a highlight. But I like that. I like kind of the pacing that they're kind of giving each of these plot lines room to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Arondir stuff continues to be just impressive to me on a craft level. The romance is still pretty underdeveloped, but like there's usually like some amazing action sequence each week that involves Arondir, and I'm enjoying that. The Galadriel stuff, I like the ideas behind the Galadriel storyline.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think the execution is still a little bit lacking in the sense that, to me, a lot of the Galadriel storyline still just feels like people doing things because like the plot requires them to do things, and not as much motivated by actions or events that occurred. So as a result, I'm kind of more mixed on that storyline.
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm in the same boat as you, but using boat for the Galadriel storyline doesn't seem
nicely done. Nicely done.
Well, you know, I try and keep my puns clever.
So there's a lot to like, and the show continues to be visually spectacular and interesting to look at, no matter what's going on. But I think some plot lines I really am enjoying more than other plot lines. That's kind of
weird. Yeah.
It's not like I'm uniformly enjoying them all equally. It's kind of
Can I ask you a question though?
Yeah,
just
please.
Because you were on the sort of Game of Thrones train for so long. Yeah. When you look at the early seasons of Game of Thrones and the sort of the pacing and the storylines, how does that compare to something like this? I know we're only 4 episodes in and Game of Thrones had more episodes per season, but like how are you feeling with it?
Well, I think that something that a lot of people have discussed is that The Rings of Power and Game of Thrones are just extremely different shows.
Yeah, yeah.
And the House of the Dragon, which is the current Game of Thrones spinoff that's on TV right now, that world is a brutal, unforgiving world in which there is basically no such thing as pure good or pure evil,
mm-hmm.
right? In which you're operating under shades of gray, and somebody who's doing something good tomorrow might be sleeping with their sister or relative and brutally torturing someone to death and whatever, you know, like that's on a weekly basis, that kind of reveal occurs.
Yeah.
Whereas Rings of Power is more like, hey, we're just going to places, looking at beautiful things. And by the way, we're trying at some point in the future, we're going to take down evil. You know, that's kind of how I feel about Rings of Power. So it's just like, It's really different, and I love that we can get both of these shows on TV at the same time.
Oh, you know, me too.
Fantasy can be like, there's some people who are very adversarial. You know, they're like, there could only be one fantasy show to rule them all. But we're not like that. We're like, no, hey, there's room for everyone.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to compare the two of them because I think they're just such different shows.
Fair.
I think also Game of Thrones season one was mostly just people sitting in rooms talking.
Yeah.
Because that's all they had the budget for.
That's true. That's true. Because didn't they, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't they cut out a major battle from season one because they ran out of money towards the end?
I don't know if that exactly is right, but there's definitely been some battles in Game of Thrones seasons one and two that were like, I remember there's like a battle and you see the people show up and they're about to attack the town and then cut to the battle's over. You know, it's like, oh, they probably didn't have money for that battle.
Yeah.
Or there was one character who is about to go into a battle, gets accidentally knocked up, conked on the head, and wakes up and the battle's over. Like that happens.
That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah.
So that's that kind of stuff happens in Game of Thrones in the earlier days. Mm. So budgetarily, it was very, very different as well. I think that one of the things that Game of Thrones did pretty well, that I think this show is doing a pretty decent job as well, as like having a moral center for the show, which was the Stark family. Ned Stark and the Starks, they were kind of the good guys and the people that you're rooting for.
Then one of them goes on to become a serial killer. It's fine.
House of the Dragon is more challenging in that regard. Like, I think we were talking on Cast of Kings, a Decoding TV podcast this past week, that like, there is no like Stark equivalent on that show. But in Rings of Power, I think it's Galadriel, right?
Yeah.
Is like who you're meant to relate with. One of the issues with the show, I think, is that Galadriel has mostly had one emotion for most of the show so far, which is determination.
Yes.
And perseverance against all odds and fighting evil. And I don't feel like that's terribly interesting so far, right? It might become more interesting as she learns challenging lessons and, you know, and needs to like adjust her approach to be more diplomatic and adjust her approach and kind of slowly transforms into the version of the character that we see in Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, right? Like, I'm interested in that journey, but so far it hasn't been that sort of nuanced, in my opinion. Do you know what I'm saying?
Totally fair.
I think with Game of Thrones and like the Starks, they're immediately learning about how complicated everything is, you know?
Yeah.
And there are some of the Starks are like, you know, we're going to do the right thing no matter what. And some of the Starks are like, wait, like, let's hold, you know? And so there's that complexity there that I don't think is quite there with Lord of the Rings, but it's a different show. So anyway, right. I hope that answered your question.
Oh, it did, and then some, but thank you. Yeah.
Sorry for going on a little.
No. Anyway, this is what we love.
Let's talk about each of the plot lines in The Rings of Power Episode 4, The Great Wave. We'll start with Numenor. This is the biggest kind of plot line that unfolds throughout the episode. We open the episode with Muriel holding a baby and talking about, I guess this is like a blessing ceremony of sorts that happens in Numenor, right?
Yeah, it's not necessarily written about, but it's not uncommon in history for the noble peoples to sort of present their children almost in the same way, like, you know, when the Pope visits somewhere and like someone holds out their baby. This is like the more refined version of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or baby baptisms or something like that.
Yeah, that too.
So she is holding a baby and everything seems to be going great. And all of a sudden, a massive flood sweeps into Numenor and destroys everything and kills everyone. Pretty good CG flood, I would say. Yeah, like really well done. Lots of detail in it. Muriel wakes up and she's like, oh, it was a dream. Or was it? Dun, dun, dun.
Surprise, this has all been taking place inside the mind of a person inside of a mental facility. It's actually Moon Knight. I'm sorry, this show is actually Moon Knight. Spoiler alert.
So we then cut to a scene of the Numenorian that Halbrand beat the crap out of last episode, and he's telling everyone, hey, these elves are taking our jobs.
Okay, so I will say, one of the main sort of complaints from a lot of people early on was that this show was very woke when they were casting people of color. And I want to make it very clear this is not that. But one of the other complaints was they were sort of loping in everything together, where woke was also like modern politics. Mm-hmm. And this particular part was a little bit too on the nose for me. It was one of those scenes where I'm like, I see where you're going, but if I may, just some of the Tolkien lore behind it was a little bit more of like, they're not necessarily scared of the elves. They just kind of want to have power, and a good way to do that is to be immortal. So like one of the main cruxes of Tolkien's lore was, you know, this sort of doing what you can with the time that is given to you. And there's that quote in the Fellowship of the Ring. And the humans of Numenor, in the books at least, some of them start to side with like the, well, what if I had all the time in the world? And that was a very driving motivation that he doesn't go into a lot of depth with, but this felt a little bit of
a departure. Just to clarify, Don Marshall, are you saying that the humans kind of wanted to be immortal, and that like that jealousy was what drove some of the conflict? Is that everything?
Yeah. I think they'll probably touch on this later, so I don't want to go into too much of like spoilery details, because we may see this fleshed out a lot. But one of the things that when you're reading the Silmarillion and learning all of this sort of backstory stuff is a lot of the rulers and the people of power in Numenor, way before all of this stuff is taking place during the show, is like, oh man, yeah, we're humans, but those elves, man, they got it good, right? They got those beautiful elven kingdoms. They live forever. Their technology is great. I want that. Why can't we have that? Mm-hmm. And so they kind of get angry in antagonistic behavior starts to pop up.
There's a kind of entitlement that the humans have.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Right. I don't know. It didn't bother me. So I think your one of your issues is the elves are taking our jobs. A, sounds like it comes from a South Park episode, right? But B, it's kind of a really on the nose way of drawing a comparison between elves versus humans and like immigrants, for instance, in modern day, right?
Yeah.
I actually didn't mind it too much because I feel like we don't, but wait till I finish the sentence, because I feel like the show hasn't done a great job of explaining the conflict between humans and elves. Mm-hmm. Right. My sense from the first episode was elves are an occupying force, but then like the Numenoreans have a whole different reason to not like elves. It's not mm-hmm. like elves aren't occupying Numenor. So they need to figure out a way to introduce some conflict between humans and elves and like give that more nuance and more definition, I think. Mm-hmm. And this is the way they chose, and I was fine with it. Like, if anything, I wish there was more detail around the elf-human conflict in the show.
Yeah.
So and the fact I'm giving that they're taking your jobs is like, okay, I guess. We're not really seeing evidence of that yet, right, mm-hmm. in the show. But this Numenorean really just doesn't like this one elf in the city. Yeah. Like, the fact that one elf is too much, right?
Yeah. So, yeah.
And it is... it is relevant and topical, you know?
Oh, it 100% is. And if that is the direction they choose to go in, I think it could certainly be an avenue to explore that could work. I just wasn't necessarily impressed with the fact that they chose that specifically. Mm-hmm. And I hope that if they do go that route, they do give it that nuance, like you said.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. Just saying they're taking our jobs is not sufficient to actually make a meaningful political statement. Right. We'll see.
Which, you know, you can just lie and make up political lie. It's like that. That's the real mirror of the real one.
Right.
Like,
well, maybe this guy is the fake news of the, you know, of the Middle Earth, right?
He's
like, the elves are taking our job. There's a caravan of elves coming to take our jobs, basically, is what he's saying. We meet again Farazon. What mm-hmm. is Farazon's position? He's a chancellor of Numenor, right?
So yeah, he's known now as the chancellor. They call him Chancellor Farazon. He's almost like I don't want to say vice president ish like, because obviously Muriel is queen regent because they've ousted the queen. So he's just like probably the number two, I'd say.
He's the number two. The queen is the number one. And then the king is the king, right?
That's
the order of – and so Farazon is the big guy with a beard. He comes in and he's like, drinks on me. Forget about the immigrant elves, guys. Everything's going to be fine, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We also meet Farazon's son, Kemen.
Yes.
Who – flirts with Eärion. Yeah. And by the way,
nice pronunciation.
Thank you. And by the way, I think has some pretty good game. You know, she has that line where she's like, I'm not going to hang out with strange men. And he's like, that's a really good idea. Like, I will let you know if I see any. I'm like, wow,
that was kind of smooth.
This guy's, he's been in this situation before, I think.
He will grow up to be a great politician.
Indeed. So anything else you want to say about kind of this opening sequence before we get to the Galadriel stuff?
So I think it was a pretty good way to introduce the episode, just the visually stunning portion of the huge dream sequence flood. I thought that was really well done. I hope they do a little bit more with the Numenor stuff and the sort of antagonistic behavior. I definitely wanted more of that. I don't necessarily find myself caring about the Kemen Aarian scenes. They feel kind of like I want to see other stuff instead, but like what they're showing me, I'm like, all right, I'll see where this goes.
Yeah, I mean, I at first I was like, well, who is this annoying guy? And then it's like, oh, well, okay, he seems like he kind of has some game, so maybe it'll be interesting to watch. But I agree, I'm like, why we're introducing Dawn. Of course, my Eeyore reaction is we're introducing new characters in episode 4. Like, we're at the halfway point at this point. We should really start tying up some of the, or start, you know, moving forward with some of the characters that we've already met. Anyway, Galadriel.
Yes.
She comes back from the Hall of Lore, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she wants to take an army to the Southlands because she believes that Hallbrand is the king of the South. I do want to say you made a prediction last week that he is not and that he's someone else. And online, I've seen quite a bit of chatter about who exactly Hallbrand actually is. And so I was very dismissive, hurtful, curt with you last week, one could say, about your theory that Hallbrand was not the king of the South. And I'm just going to reel that back a little bit. I'm going to be
right.
I'm a little more open to what Dawn Marshall might have to tell me about Hallbrand. but yeah, so whatever the case, Galadriel is convinced he's king of the South. I guess, like, do you have any non-spoilery thoughts on who he might be at this point?
So, my comment sections have been flooded with who is the stranger, who is Hal Brand, is he this, is he that? I have no proof for any of this. And here is what I think is going to happen in a sort of, like, to maybe address some of your concerns, David, as well. I think they are making Galadriel this sort of hot-headed, sort of not necessarily non-nuanced, because I think there's some nuance to her performance, but she hasn't really learned any lessons along the way. I think the lesson we are going to learn with Galadriel is going to come as a huge shock, and I don't know if it's going to be the end of season one or like maybe
it's gotta be season one.
Like it needs to be season one so that when she comes back in season two, she's like, okay, I'm a new person, we're changing things up. And Hallbrand is just so smug and I like him so much, and that is just a huge red flag for me. I'm sorry, he's charming and personable and I want him to be the good guy, but there's something that tells me he's not who he says he is.
Yeah. And we were talking earlier about how to make Galadriel potentially a more interesting character. Her kind of having this extremely firm belief that is then shattered.
Yeah.
That would create some character development, presumably. So
I hope so.
I'm much more leaning into the perhaps Hallbrand is not who we all think he is camp at this point. So
all right.
That is my formal apology for being so dismissive last week.
My feelings were not hurt last week.
That said, if I do turn out to be right and he is just the king of the South, I will totally gloat about it when that reveal occurs. Okay?
Fair. Totally fair.
So Muriel says she's not going to help with this battle in the Southlands. And Galadriel's like, I need to speak. Galadriel does her best Karen impression and is like, speak with the manager, which is Muriel's father. And Muriel gets so pissed at that she throws her into jail, where she kind of talks with Hallbrand. By the way, I thought Muriel, kind of summing up my own thoughts on Galadriel's plotline this episode when she says, you know, I welcome you as a guest and you gallop off to our countryside to steal ancient scrolls while your Southland companion assaults our citizenry, end quote.
Yeah.
Which is like, wow, yeah, she She's right. Galadriel really hasn't been, they really haven't availed themselves. They haven't clothed themselves in glory since coming to Numenor.
No, they're not doing any favors to help make amends with that elf human relationship right now, are they?
I don't think so.
A little bit.
So she goes to jail. Halbrand talks to her, is like, you need to, he says to her, you know, you need to cool it a little bit and like take it easy and learn to use some diplomacy here. So anyway, before any more conversation can happen, Farazan comes in with some men, is like, we're going to take you back to your home under armed escort. She there's a mini action scene, I guess, where she kind of shoves all these dudes into the jail cell. You like this scene, right?
I think this is an okay action scene. I think I would have liked to see a little bit more of, like, in the same way that we can see Arondir do all of these amazing stunts, I want to watch Morvith Clark do just like an amazing acrobatics thing. Like, riding the horse was great. I thought that was fun. But like, I want to see why the elves are just so much better equipped to handle humans. And I think by cutting away to not seeing how she throws all four of these very armed guards into this jail cell and shuts the door, cheapened that a little bit.
To me, it felt like they ran out of money on the shoot. They're like, hey, we could have an intricate choreographed action scene, or we'll just show her shoving it into the cell, and like, that's gonna be it. No one's gonna ask any questions about that. So it's like, yeah. Okay, it's fine. You know, the show spends lots of money in other places. We're gonna see a badass Galadriel action scene at some point, it was a little bit silly in terms of its execution, I thought. Galadriel storms up into the castle to see the king, right? Realizes that the king is actually in bad shape, and Muriel probably had good reasons for not taking her to see him.
Yeah.
Muriel kind of lays out the whole history of their people, which is basically like the king was really into elf-human alliances, but people didn't like it. And essentially, when she took over, she's like, okay, the elf-human relationships are over. I'm doing a pretty reductive job of explaining it, so do you want to give some more color to that?
I can give a little bit more backstory. So obviously this goes into more detail in like books like the Silmarillion, and we get a little bit more of a nuance, we keep using this word, but yes, it is a little bit more nuanced. So the way this works is there's a bit of a confusing detail, but the king is basically the first king of Numenor was Elrond's brother, Elros, who we learned last week was friendly to the elves and they had good relationships. And then over time, you know, they got distant and, you know, some of that sentiment started to grow sour. Muriel's father in the books was one of the first kings in a while, I think, to be a friend to the elves, or at least be non-hostile to them. And sometimes when you're trying to push an agenda, the agenda doesn't always work and people push the opposite. And so Muriel's father was basically a victim of his own hubris and trying to be a those bright-eyed and bushy-tailed politicians that are like, I alone am going to change the world. And then they get in there and they realize like, oh, there's a system in place specifically designed to stop me from doing what I want to keep the people in power. That's basically kind of how I read into this. Like, yes, he's the king, but everybody else is like, no, Numenor first. Numenor first.
Make Numenor great again, I think is what everyone is feeling.
I hate that you're right, but yeah, that's basically it, in like the worst possible way, though.
So then Muriel comes to power, and she's like, well, the people don't want the elf-human relationships, and so we're just going to have to keep things the way they are, right? So then Muriel takes Galadriel to see this object called the Palantir, which is like a seeing stone.
Yes,
I guess,
so
right?
These, we actually see one of these in the Lord of the Rings movies. This is the thing that Saruman the White, Christopher Lee's character, he's holding his hand over and talking to Sauron. This is how they communicate. So there were originally seven of these seeing stones. They were made by, here's a little bit of a callback, they were made by Feanor, that elf that we mentioned in episode 2, who made the hammer, that was like the most powerful elf and is responsible for most of the death in the world, because of that war. in the first age.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's his fault, but you know, I won't get too into the weeds here. But yeah, Feanor made the Palantir as means of communication, and the Palantir have a way of providing vision, whether that's the future, the past, what is currently happening, to where things are. And the way that Galadriel sort of approaches it and touches it is sort of giving her that same sort of, you know, dream sequence. And I quite like that. I thought that was really well done. But yeah, these Palantir are sort of yet another notch in the sort of fast and loose magic style that Tolkien runs with, where he doesn't really follow a set of rules. It's just kind of convenient for him to have them exist. And yeah, they're cool, but like, how do they work? Elf magic, I think.
Well, my favorite part of the episode with Galadriel, at least, is when she's like, hey, if you touch the Palantir, you know, crazy stuff's gonna happen. And mm-hmm. Galadriel's like, I've touched a Palantir before, okay?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You don't need to you don't need to go over what a Palantir is, okay? I know what it is.
It's not my first rodeo.
It's not my first Palantir rodeo.
Yeah.
I kind of love that moment. But she's like, you haven't touched this one. And in fact, Galadriel feels quite disquieted by what actually occurs,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So she touches a Palantir. She sees kind of the wave thing happen from the first scene of the episode. It's also, I think, one of the shots in this sequence is basically used in some of the key art with, you know, the leaves, the flowers kind of blowing at her from the tower. You know, mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. a very lovely shot. And then she realizes, wow, Numenor is in for a bad time. And I guess their interpretation is that if they do what Galadriel says, like that the prophecy of this flooding will come true.
So I think they're kind of going for a little bit of a, you have a decision to make as an island of Numenor, and if you make the wrong decision, it's going to be, you know, bad times for you, and the flood will come, I think.
Yeah. So, and the idea is that, like, hey, here's a elf coming in and telling us to do this big, bold thing mm-hmm. that seems extremely risky and for which there is very little chance of success, and maybe if we listen to her, this terrible thing will befall us, kind of, right?
Potentially, yeah.
But then they put her on the ship, she starts leaving, and that's when the leaves start blowing in. Now, the leaves or the flowers are interpreted to be the tears of the Valar. Mm. Please remind us, Don Marshall, who are the Valar?
Right. So the Valar are they call them the gods in the show. I refer to them as the lesser gods because there's technically one god, but these are basically like the beings within the physical world that are the top notch, the top dog. They literally shaped the world at the beginning of time. And the elves know they exist and they fought alongside them, and so did a bunch of humans. And they basically gave the humans, these Numenoreans, this island, basically Tolkien's version of Atlantis, as a gift to say, hey, thanks. And I loved this scene with the flowers because it is so emblematic of capturing the spirit of Tolkien. There's a great part in the Return of the King book where Aragorn is looking for a sign to, you know, realize that he needs to become king and that this is his right moment. And he finds a blooming a flower or a tree. I don't remember the specific details, but he finds it in nature as he is sort of exploring. And so the idea of like nature and the world around you giving you signs that you are on the right path or on the wrong path is very emblematic of Tolkien throughout pretty much everything he ever wrote. So I thought this was really well done. I thought the music in this scene was absolutely brilliant too. Bear McCreary knocked it out of the park here.
It's a beautiful sequence. And the idea is that they interpret sending her off as the thing that might cause the pain. And mm-hmm, mm-hmm. so then they're like, okay, then they do a 180. They're like, okay, we got to, Galadriel's right. We got to recruit people.
Mm-hmm.
And they start recruiting people to sail off and help to defeat the evil in the Southlands. Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. Is kind of what they're doing.
Yeah. And now, and just, sorry, real quick, if I may just give a quick detail. For those that maybe aren't as familiar with First Age mythology, I won't give you too many, I won't go too deep into it, but suffice to say, if you feel like the gods getting involved through like nature symbols, this has happened many times. The Valar get involved a lot in the First Age, and the Second Age is sort of their way to say, all right, we're not going to get as involved, but like, we're going to at least try and point you in the right direction.
All right. A couple of other details to point out. One is that you had clocked that Halbrand was apparently let go, probably by Farazan, for helping Farazan figure out what Galadriel's plan was, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he is seen freely, like at the towards the end of the episode.
They're doing the like, who will join me on this trip? And it's like, I will serve. There's a quick shot of Halbrand standing on a bridge, walking freely. I took that to mean that when Halbrand was still in jail, he told Farazan where to find Galadriel, because obviously he knew where she was going. And so Farazan is like, I don't know if I trust you. And I kind of wish we had seen this, but I assume Halbrand is like, if you let me go, I'll tell you where she's going.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I feel like we might see that a little bit later. And like, maybe Halbrand gets in with Farazan a little bit, but we'll see.
We'll see. Or maybe it's a statement on the fact that people can, you know, be recruited for military action, even if they're in jail in Numenor, you know?
They're a very
militaristic society that we're not yet familiar with. So
we might see that. I have a feeling we might see that.
One of the other people that volunteers is Isildur.
Mm-hmm.
We got a little bit more of his plotline today. I thought the Isildur stuff was, I have to say, kind of silly this episode. What I mean is, he's trying to try out for the Sea Guard, and he's on the ship, and then these islands, my understanding is they're to the west, are calling to him, right? But you tell me, Dom, what was your interpretation of that scene?
This is something that I hope we get a little bit explained a little bit more. I don't necessarily know where they're going with this, even through, you know, all of the lore that I have in my head. But if I'm remembering correctly, I think Numenor is just one big island. So it almost seems as though he is staring off into another part of the island. I don't know what that has in store for Isildur, but yeah, I'm kind of with you on this one. Isildur's plotline is maybe the least interesting to me, at least for right now. But I hope at the very least they're sort of setting him up to play a much larger role, because also keep in mind, right, he's younger at this point. His dad is the sort of maybe more important one right now, and we will maybe see him grow through these hopefully 5 seasons of the show.
So we see Isildur taking his final exam for the Sea Guard, this thing that we didn't even know he was doing until last episode, I think, right? And then he basically throws the exam by not doing a very critical thing. And then the guy's like, you're out of the Sea Guard. And not only that, your buddies are out of the Sea Guard too. And it's like, whoa, okay. Didn't even know that was a thing. And I guess it's really harsh if you mess up one thing. The guy even says to him, you've done it correctly every single time I've seen you do it. But because you messed up this one time, you're out of the Sea Guard. Why did they throw out his friends? Probably just so Isildur has friends to hang out with for whatever his adventure is next, is my guess.
That
right?
Felt a little convenient to the plot. Yeah, yeah. I honestly think it would have been meant a little even more if the friends didn't get kicked out and decided to go anyway, right? Because we got them in episode 2 saying like, I can't wait to do this. This is going to be so great. 5 years and we'll be, or however long it takes, and we'll have our own ship. And then like, to basically say, no, I'm going to give all that up and I'm going to go fight because my friend is needing me. I feel like that might give the friends a little bit more agency, but you know.
I just think it's pretty rough storytelling to introduce a thing like last episode that we didn't even know about. It's like he's trying to be in the Sea Guard, but he kind of maybe doesn't really, his heart's really not in it. And then all of a sudden he's out of the Sea Guard. And it's like, well, what was the point of introducing the Sea Guard plotline at all? Like,
yeah, it's a little disjointed for me.
Could we have
too.
Just started with Isildur? I guess the idea is that he had lost something, and then, you know, and then he's like going on this journey to kind of make up for it in some ways, or finding new renewed purpose in life because of it. But yeah, it does feel a little bit odd.
Anyway, yeah, a bit out of place.
A bit too like paint by numbers of like, oh, he needs to lose something before he goes on the big journey. So we're going to have him lose the Sea Guard thing that we're barely going to introduce. But anyway, not a problem, not a huge problem.
Yeah, no, I'm indifferent right now.
So that's the Numenor stuff.
Yep.
Before we get to the rest of the episode, let's talk about the Southland stuff real quick. The Southland stuff seems to be pretty isolated from the rest of the plot. It seems to be like on its own right now, right?
And David, I don't know if I want to get too deep into this with you. Have you been looking online at any number of theories about the Southland's plotline?
No.
Okay.
No.
This is a potential theory that I have seen floated around a few times. Those of you that follow me.
Let me guess what the theory is before you even say what it is.
Go for it.
I have not seen any theories. I'm just guessing, okay?
Okay, go for it.
That the Southlands plot is taking place during a different time frame than everything else in the show.
That's absolutely correct.
Yes. That's something that happened in Westworld, which is another TV show that this not only has happened multiple times in Westworld. It's just another television show that Decoding TV has covered in the past. So, I've seen it all, Don Marshall. You cannot surprise me anymore. But okay, so some people speculate the Southland stuff might be taking place during a different time frame.
Yes.
What say you, Don Marshall?
I liked the idea. I don't necessarily know if it is true, but I think it would make for an incredible reveal with like the Galadriel plotline converging with the Arondir plotline or the Theo plotline in that I like Theo, and I've had the pleasure of meeting Tyro Mahaffadin twice. He's a great dude. But I think if Theo gets a scar in the next few episodes, that's like the one you see on his arm in this one. And we see that, but it's on the arms of like an old man or like this angry person. I think we are operating in multiple timelines. I think that would be a pretty cool twist because
is Theo Morgoth or Sauron or
no, what do you... no. I think so. Morgoth is currently in what's called the void. It's basically like the jail for gods. I don't think he's going to be a factor at all unless they go completely off the rails with the lore. Could he be Sauron? Potentially. My guess is probably that he, and again, this is a theory, so if you don't want me to spoil something, maybe skip ahead 30 seconds. I think Theo is probably one of the Nazgul, and I think he is going to get recruited by Adar or corrupted by Adar, and we will see when Galadriel gets to the Southlands that he is a much older guy, and
Older Theo later on.
We may see older Theo, which kind of works with the timeline because Arondir would still be alive and potentially like some sort of like ranger fighting against him, or maybe they have him captive somewhere. I don't know. The possibilities are endless, but I think leaning more towards the multiple timelines theory.
Interesting. Why? Any reason why? Like, are there things in the plotline that give you a sense that it might be?
It's so disjointed right now that I don't like. Think about it like this, right? We've watched Arondir get captured by these orcs who are hiding in a tunnel, right? And there's sulfur pits and this thing that they're looking for something, but like, it doesn't strike me as like the Southlands are in like danger from an occupying army. It's just like we haven't really seen the full might of the orcs, right? And to me, I don't really feel all that threatened by oh god, the orcs are invading. It's just like if the Numenoreans come in with a big enough army, you can wipe them out. I haven't seen the army of the orcs, and so to me, I want to be able to be like, oh man, now they're screwed because they've had all of that time to grow. And what we've been watching was just the start. And now that we've seen it start to grow, we're like, oh, shoot, Galadriel and Halbrand and whoever goes with them are screwed.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I suspect we're going to find out pretty soon.
Yeah.
And it's always exciting when you're watching a show like this and like two of the plot lines converge, because Galadriel is heading to the Southlands with Numenor fighters probably, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
my
guess is the next 2 weeks we're going to find out what happens.
And this is where I think we're going to get episode
be 100% Harfoot and we don't find out anything about it. Your favorite, Don. That'd be your favorite.
Listen. I love the cottagecore vibes of the Harfoots. But they are a little bit more disconnected. Like, heck, we might just find out that the Harfoot plotline isn't even related to anything having to do with it. And they just
the Harfoots took place in the First Age, maybe. So anyway, well, it's an interesting theory, and I wouldn't put it past the show. And it would account for the fact that this plot line seems completely disconnected from the other plot lines right now, right? There was this thing earlier in the episode where in episode one, where Arandir is kind of called back home, right? He's supposed to leave, right? And I was like, is that related to anything that's going on with Galadriel right now? Because I had thought maybe he's supposed to go to Valinor too, you know, but I don't.
Here's my thought. Let's say Gil-galad says the war is over, sends word to the watchtowers, the war is over, right?
All of the elves
try and go home.
Yeah.
Well, let's say that if this Southlands plot is taking place in the past, that gives a little bit more credence to the idea of Galadriel. All of that stuff happened ages ago. Gil-galad brought in everybody from the watchtowers years ago. There's nothing out there anymore. Well, wouldn't you know it? All of a sudden, it's like, oh, the watchtower stuff in the Southlands was happening. There was a threat out there, and Gil-galad was wrong to bring everybody back because the threat was just right there. So we'll see.
All right, we'll see. I mean, how silly are you going to feel if, you know, they, if Galadriel meets young Theo next week and it's like clearly of the same timeline?
A little silly. I won't lie. I won't lie. I will be just a little bit disappointed.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, Arandir.
Arandir.
He, at the end of last episode. Oh, but you know, actually, one other thing, Don, I wanted to mention.
Yeah, please.
I think we missed this detail from last week's episode.
Hmm.
Before we move on from Numenor, there was a scene where Muriel says to Aeorian's dad, who is Elendil, I think.
Elendil, right? Yes.
Elendil, he's like, hey, you need to do this thing for me. Mm-hmm. And then she like gives him a sword or something like that.
Yes.
I don't think we know what the thing is yet, do we? Yes. Or
okay, so no, there was, I can't believe I missed this in my notes. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So there is one shot that I think is an Easter egg for now, but may play a little bit more of a role. There is a shot of Galadriel looking at a sword, and she kind of glances at it, and I think recognizes it. I believe this sword that she looks at when she's sort of in this room with Muriel and her father is Narsil, the sword that we see reforged in the Third Age. There is also potentially a shield that is an Easter egg from the First Age. I won't get too much into it because that's a book only thing. But yeah, I think there's a Narsil that we may see later on.
Gotcha. But going back to the thing I was bringing up, do you know you know how Muriel presents Elendil like a sword, or is like, I need you to do this thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then do we ever find out what that was? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I was getting my swords confused.
Yeah.
I think it was just to keep an eye on her. I don't think it was to kill Galadriel if she causes too much trouble.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay.
There were multiple swords passed
multiple
around.
Multiple swords. There's just a lot of swords in the show.
Yeah.
It's a sword full show. Okay. So anyway, and I guess he did keep an eye on her by escorting her to the Hall of Lore and stuff like that last week.
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Sorry about the tangent. Southlands this week. Arandir, at the end of last episode, he was like being brought to Adar.
Mm-hmm.
The orcs are like, we got to bring you to Adar.
Mm-hmm.
So they bring him to Adar and they make him watch this death ceremony that Adar does on one of the other orcs, right?
Mm-hmm.
The orcs is like not in good shape, and then Adar kills him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mercy kills him.
Yeah.
And then Adar and Arandir speak, and I was genuinely shocked, Don Marshall, that Adar was an elf.
Yeah.
I did not see that coming.
That threw me for a little bit, and I don't know if anybody else feels this way. I was really surprised because I actually kind of think it looked like Galadriel's brother a little bit. It was, and maybe it was the cheekbones and the elf. I'm like,
you're saying the blurry picture from last episode, right?
The blurry picture, and then when you sort of transition, I was like, wait, is that Galadriel's brother? Oh, okay. So it's definitely a different actor, but I'm like, did they bring Galadriel's brother back from the dead? And like, he's, because elves can reincarnate when they die. They go to a purgatory place, and then they can be not necessarily reincarnated, but they can come back. And I was like, that's not Galadriel's brother, is it? And it wasn't, as far as I'm aware, right? He still goes by Adar, but they're speaking in the subtitles in an elvish language called Quenya, which is almost all spoken in the Undying Lands, the place we saw in the prologue that was basically paradise. Most of the elves that are here in Middle-earth speak an elvish called Sindarin. And I thought it was very interesting that they pointed out that he is speaking in Quenya, because that leads me to believe that he was probably an elf from the Undying Lands that came over during the war. Maybe we got a quick shot of him and we just missed it or what, but yeah, this definitely feels like some sort of corrupted elf servant of Sauron almost right now.
Did they, when you say they pointed out that they're speaking Quenya, I saw that in the subtitles. Did they also say it out loud?
No, they didn't. They said it, they said in, they literally, yeah, I believe the words Quenya or in Quenya, it's in the subtitles.
Fascinating. Yeah. Well, it's awesome to see Joseph Maul, who plays Adar in Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power. He also played Uncle Benjen in Game of Thrones.
Yep, same dude.
Beloved character in that show, so... And Adar communicates to Arendir, hey, you got to go back and tell these people to surrender their claim to their lands and serve me, I guess, right?
Basically like a, you need to leave or we're going to enslave you.
Yeah. And there is this great line where he says, you know, I'm not a god yet, basically. This guy's got some confidence.
Yeah.
He's got this thing under control.
Yeah.
I thought the performance of Adar was really amazing.
I think he did a great job.
Especially because up until now, we've only seen elves be in a certain aesthetic, right? Mm-hmm. They're all like noble badasses fighting for the forces of good. And then to see one that's kind of like orc-like is really unsettling. And so I really loved, go ahead.
I have another theory about potentially who Adar may be. Mm-hmm. So in the Silmarillion, and I don't know how much they can sort of use, the showrunners, that is, how much they can use as far as like this kind of content. But in the Silmarillion, the orcs are corrupted elves. They are kidnapped. They are, you know, basically dark magic, infused with dark magic and kind of almost like brutalized to the point of like their mind breaking. It would not surprise me if like Adar is one of the first orcs or like the leader of the orcs, and they're coming for they're looking for the sword, and this is like the first sword that they used or like a Morgul blade for the Nazgul. But yeah, this definitely strikes me as like he's someone. I just don't know who yet. I don't think he's Sauron though.
So what else is going on at the same time is we saw Bronwyn and Theo leave with all their people last episode. They take shelter in this watchtower. They don't have any supplies. Bronwyn is like, let's go and scavenge for food. Theo's like, no, we got to go back to the town that we were in, get the food from there because we have tons of supplies. And Bronwyn's like, it's overrun with orcs though. So then Theo goes with his friend to scavenge, encounters orcs, almost dies, intersects with Arendir, who comes in and saves his ass, and then they flee to the woods. Bronwyn shows up somehow. She's there as well.
I don't know why she's there.
She sensed that Arendir was close.
Yeah, it's a maternal instinct. You get that kind of GPS when you become a mother, I think.
I was gonna say it was more of an Arendir connection, but you know, whatever. Oh. Either way. I liked, it's some nice, beautiful, classic Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson-esque filmmaking of, you know, the elf catches the arrow and then turns it around and uses it against it.
Oh, it's so cool.
I'm a sucker for that stuff. I'm a sucker.
Oh, no, that was great. You know? That was so great. I think that whole sequence from the long take with Theo, I don't know if anybody's played Shadow of Mordor or Shadow of War. It's like a stealth video game where you basically play a ranger and sneak through a bunch of brush and undercover. This scene made me feel like I was like back in that game hiding from orcs trying to run away. And I love that sequence, the slow motion arrow firing, and just the action sequence was amazing. And then the wide shot with the sun and Arendir and Bronwyn kind of just standing there when he's holding the sword is like quintessential Tolkien, only to immediately cut to one of my biggest shocks of the episode. We find out that it's actually Disa singing in Moria. And we'll get to that plot line in a minute, but I just thought that was a very brilliant sequence and felt very Peter Jackson Tolkien-esque to me. I thought that was very well done.
Yeah. We close the episode with Arendir having gotten everyone to safety. Theo talks with an old man. Theo is a hero because he was able to get these important supplies. Mm-hmm. And he talks to this old man who knows about Theo having the blade, because I think the old man had the blade. And like,
yes,
Theo took it from him and basically says, you need to get ready. That stranger coming in the meteor, that's a sign about the things that are going to come. Whether or not he's right about that, I don't think we know.
We'll see.
I think it's an interesting idea, Don, because in general, in most of fantasy and science fiction, a lot of prophecies are about good things that are going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. You're the one. You are the prince that was promised. You are the blah, 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 blah. This is like, seems to be a prophecy about an evil thing that's going to come and happen. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you need to be ready for the evil thing because you might be one of his soldiers or whatever it is going to be. But it's a nice creepy way to end that kind of plot line. I didn't know if you had any of the thoughts.
No, not too many thoughts on that one. I thought it was kind of a nice wrap up because I didn't know whose sword it was. And I'm glad that they introduced, you know, dissension in the ranks with that guy being like, yeah, no, we got to lean into this Sauron thing. He's going to give us power. So I feel like we're going to get some betrayal if Adar decides to attack this tower at any point. And, you know, maybe they'll be saved by Galadriel and company, or maybe Arendir will defeat him in combat. And I don't know. We'll see.
All right, Don, before we move on to the final plot lines this episode, let's talk a little bit about where people can find more of your work on the internet this week.
Yes. Hello, my name is Don. I go by DonMarshall72 on all social medias. I'm on TikTok, which is my main platform. I also stream live on Twitch. We do watch parties for the Rings of Power every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. I also have a YouTube channel, a Twitter, an Instagram, all that stuff. And I very recently just launched a completely revamped Patreon, which gets you a whole bunch of bonus stuff. And it is only $2. However, because we are on this podcast, I must say, please subscribe to the podcast first, because there is some amazing content coming out of this. I have had the pleasure of listening to most of it, David. You do a remarkable job.
Oh, thanks so much. But yes, definitely, if you have grown to love Middle Earth and want to do a deep dive, Don Marshall is one of the best resources out there. So check out all of his stuff. We'll link to a bunch of it in the show notes. I do want to also say, in addition to Don's work, one resource that I consider essential to understanding the Rings of Power as a TV show and TV in general is Miles McNutt's Episodic Medium newsletter. I would highly recommend you check it out at episodicmedium.substack.com. I've been a fan of Miles for probably over a decade. We've kind of both come up in this TV criticism space together in different ways. And I'd really recommend you check out Episodic Medium on Substack, episodicmedium.substack.com. They're recapping House of the Dragon. They're recapping Andor. They're recapping Rings of Power and a bunch of other stuff. Basically, if you subscribe to Decoding TV, .com and Episodic Medium, you're all of your TV needs are met, in my opinion. So check all that stuff out. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more on The Rings of Power episode 4.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
All right, Don Marshall. Let's talk about Elrond this episode. We got to see Elrond and Durin and Celebrimbor again. So first of all, major shock to me, Don, which is you see Elrond and Celebrimbor again this episode, and they're working to build the forge. It looks as though months have passed since the last episode where you saw this.
Yeah.
Am I right about it? Like, are elves just really fast builders, or have months passed on?
So the way I'm interpreting this is they're kind of playing a little fast and loose with the timelines here, which is why I was on the multiple timelines thing before the break. But this strikes me as, yeah, they've been building for a while, and it's kind of almost like its own separate thing. Here's why I don't think that's necessarily a problem. Because it is going to, just from a geological standpoint, take Galadriel and all of those people, if they are going to the Southlands, it's going to take them a very long time. It's going to take a while for the army to get there. They can, through the power of television, just show up there eventually, but it's going to take time. So I think what we are seeing is a little bit of a difference in the timeline. So, like, yeah, it's probably been a few weeks or months. Yeah, dwarves do work that fast, but maybe not that fast, because Galadriel's been there for maybe like 3 days, I think. But yeah,
but I think what is clear is probably that the show is structuring the timeline so that when the characters intersect, right, it's obviously, it's all building to some of these characters meeting each other. Right?
Yes.
And when
yes.
they meet each other, it will obviously be at the same time. They'll mm-hmm. be in the same point in their timelines, but that that the stuff that we're seeing on a per episode basis might not be taking place at the same time.
Yes, I think that is 100% the case, because I was a little bit shocked too. I'm like, oh, Elrond's back with Celebrimbor. That's cool. Yeah. I really appreciated Charles Edwards's performance in episode 2, and I think he brings it home again in episode 3. He's this sort of like almost absent-minded, delusions of grandeur kind of elf that very much wants to sort of come out from under his family name and make a name for himself.
Celebrimbor also gives this nice story talking about Elrond's dad and his memory of him. Mm-hmm. Nice character moment.
Yeah.
I'm loving the Elrond character moments in general, you know?
Yeah.
I think they're nice. So Elrond goes to visit Durin because he wants to find out where Durin is. What do you remember what the motivation was for that again? Like, why did he?
I think it was something along the lines of Durin's not interacting with Celebrimbor.
Right.
And there are more things that Celebrimbor sort of needs. And to do that, you need to sort of nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Hey, can you help me out here? I got the sense that Durin was avoiding Celebrimbor and is either, you know, went back to Moria or never showed up to Eregion in the first place. So Elrond goes back. I don't necessarily know if we needed the scene with Celebrimbor, but I think they wanted to show that there was progress happening because of, again, this is just a theory, the whole accelerated, condensed, multiple timelines thing.
Yes. You know, Don, you were doubtful that we might, I mean, we had questioned whether we might see this forge completed in this season, but I think it's making good progress. I would be shocked if it wasn't completed by the end of the season.
I think we are going to see that sort of come to fruition at the beginning, or rather at the end of this season, and then the beginning of next season. Maybe there's a time skip or something, but we will see the real forge light up.
Elrond goes to visit Durin. Durin's not home. Disa's home. They have basically a duel of lies. not really.
It's just a bunch of people in the room sitting around and talking like Game of Thrones.
Exactly. But she, you know, he's like, why isn't Durin here? And she's like, well, he's off at the blah. And then he says, well, if he's really there, then wouldn't this be true? And wouldn't this be true? And would this be true? And she's like, well, here's explanations for every single one of those things. Back off, Elrond. But of course, Disa is lying about all that stuff. Mm-hmm. The real fact of the matter is that Durin is digging for what we later find out is Mithril, right?
Yep.
And the reason why he's concealing that fact is because he doesn't want his dad to know about it, because it's dangerous to do this. So, love seeing Disa again. They have a great chemistry. She has great chemistry with all the other characters.
Oh, she's I think Sophia does an amazing job as Disa. That is just one of the highlights of each episode. I love seeing her on screen.
What did you think of this whole plot line? For me, a little bit weird to see the Mithril reveal. Like, why does Elrond know what Mithril is called? That was what was weird to me.
Okay, you know? So yeah, yeah no, me. I yeah. can I can explain that a little bit, because this did confuse a couple of people in my comment section. So Durin says that they are calling it Grey Glitter. Mm-hmm. However, he says it in the common tongue, in English, basically. But he doesn't give the Dwarvish word for it, because the Dwarvish language is a secret. So when Durin says we call it Grey Glitter, he then translates it into Elvish, which was something like Mithrond. But Elrond corrects him, saying, no, the Elvish word for gray glitter is Mithril. So he doesn't actually he doesn't have all of the knowledge and the backstory of what it is. He's literally just translating the word that Durin told him.
I see. That's what I thought, but it's not clear in the show, and the show kind of makes it into a very almost like prequel-itis moment where it's like, it's called Mithril, and it's okay, I don't know why, it's weird that he would know that, but that's a good explanation, and I knew you'd have an answer for me about that. So there's a massive collapse at the mine, and four of Durin's men are trapped, and Disa performs a beautiful song, a plea to the rocks to release the bodies within the mines. And
with breath still, yeah, it is with breath still inside them, I think was the thing that hit home for me. It's like, oh, you are quite literally asking your god to move mountains. And I mean that in the literal sense, because the god that created the dwarves, Aule, this is one of the Valar, like we were talking about before. Aule is like the father to all dwarves and created all of them. And so when they're singing to him, and we see that very cool moment of resonance where the singing actually moves the silt and the stone that is as it shakes, I thought that was a brilliantly done scene. I thought that was really, really well done.
It was really cool. And also the idea of this reverence to the mountain, I think, is really lovely, lovingly rendered in the show. Earlier on, I think he makes Elrond swear to the mountain, right?
Yep.
And the reverence for the mountain is really, it's cool to see. It's not something you see in a normal TV show, you know? So
no, and this is, again, this is very much Tolkien, right? The dwarven aspect of nature is very different than the elven. Durin makes him swear on the mountain itself. And then Elrond is like, all right, I will put my hand on this stone, but I will also bring my own culture into this. I swear on the memory of my father, Eärendil.
Yeah. Fortunately, they're pulled out alive, and Durin is really not happy about needing to talk with his dad about it. But Elrond gives him this talk about how, hey, even getting yelled at by your dad is a blessing.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a nice chat, is a nice idea, you know, the idea that even if your parent is, I guess, unless it's really toxic and a painful relationship, but even if your parent is disciplining you or is disappointed in you, it's still a way of your parent connecting with you, you know? Yeah. And I thought that was a powerful idea.
There was one line, it's Durin says something like, sometimes I wish I could tell him exactly what I think of him. And then Elrond gives this amazing lore drop for, you know, anyone that's read the Silmarillion is like, oh, they're using the backstory of Elrond's, because Elrond is such a tragic character. He's, you know, his father is held as one of the greatest of all time. His mother as well. His brother, he has already lost his brother because his brother chose to be human, and Numenor is his brother's legacy. Meanwhile, here's Elrond just trying to do something with himself. And I wrote down the line because I thought it was so great. I would be only too happy to hear any judgment, so long as it granted me the opportunity to have but one more conversation with my father. Do not waste what time you have left with yours. That hit home. I think for me and for a lot of people, we're bringing our own emotional baggage into it, but it was really well crafted. I think Robert Jaramillo did a fantastic job in that.
Agreed. There is a recounting of how Elrond and Durin met. Elrond says he saved Durin from three trolls. Do you know how Elrond and Durin met from the books? No,
I don't, unfortunately. No, I am glad that we have that sort of moment of levity after what is a very serious sort of heartfelt moment. Disa comes in to sort of lighten the mood. And I love that kind of dynamic because it feels very much like the Legolas and Gimli friendship when they're jiving back and forth and ribbing each other. And just I think that relationship to me is one of the ones that have the best chemistry in the show.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Durin has a conversation with his dad, asks for forgiveness. His dad says there's nothing to forgive. I thought this played out a little bit too cleanly. I think there's probably a lot of subtext here that I just wasn't getting, you know, the idea that like, why does his dad say there's nothing to forgive? I don't really understand, you know?
Yeah.
I don't really sense that we know the full extent of his dad's anger, right? Because I think, wasn't the last time we saw them when they were opening the case of Mithril, and then now this time he's like already digging for it, right? Is that, was there anything in between that?
I think the implication was that they have been digging for this in secret for a while. Durin, his dad, Durin the Third, probably shut it down the first time. And so they're now doing it the second time in secret, but it's, that part was a little bit unclear. But I think,
well, the big question, Don, is, and I'm hoping you can help with this, is Durin, when he's talking about the Mithril, is saying how this will be like an important object that could, or an important resource that could revitalize their homeland, right? Mm-hmm. Khazad Dûm, mm-hmm. Moria, like the whole area. But to me, I was unclear, like, is the homeland in trouble in any way? Because it seems like it's thriving, right? And that's what's, I think, is a little confusing, is this whole set of actions between Durin and his dad would make more sense to me if I understood the full extent of what was going on in the mountain and why it was troubled. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think they haven't explained as much what that is. I sort of see it as, you know, they need... It almost feels right now, and maybe they'll flesh this out a bit more, as like a means to an end. Because I don't see the mountain being in trouble. I don't see the dwarves, you know, struggling to build anything.
In the books, is that the case though? Like in the books, is Khazad Dûm on the decline in the books?
As far as I'm aware, and I am not like sort of the dwarven expert in the lore when it comes to that sort of thing. I don't believe the dwarves are facing any trouble like that. But I feel like to me, they're just kind of presenting it like, this is like the Wright brothers inventing, or like the internet, or, this next step in our culture that will shift. Cause like, remember, if you've got 100,000 dwarves in Mithril armor, nobody's stopping you. You can take down as many dragons as you want. Mm. You can conquer any mountain you want, and you'd basically be an unstoppable force.
I guess I'm curious, like, how are the dwarves thought of by the world at large at this time? You know, would that help answer?
Are
they kind of like seen as the underdogs, or potentially because their stature is not as high, like maybe people look down on them literally or metaphorically? Or I'm curious.
I mean, definitely literally because of the size difference, but metaphorically, I don't think... Second age wise, we haven't really gotten any indication that like the dwarves are like, we know that there's a rift between humans and elves in Numenor, right? I don't think we've gotten any indication from a TV show aspect of whether or not the dwarves are hated or disliked or looked down upon in any way. And as far as I'm aware, no, I don't think they are. But I would definitely like to see more of that culture explored.
Yeah. So in that case, I think it's just a pretty confusing scene. Given all that, you know, and of course, if you know details about dwarves and how they were viewed during this time period, let us know at decodingtv@gmail.com. But I trust Don. And if the dwarves are held in high esteem, then I don't know what's going on in this scene. Anyway, I guess Peter Mullen, who plays Durin's dad, mm-hmm. amazing actor,
who's
also appeared in Westworld.
Did he?
He was the guy in charge of Westworld, basically. Amazing actor. And yeah, the idea is that, hey, he forgives him, or there's nothing to forgive because he understands fundamentally what Durin was trying to do, which mm-hmm. is help their people out, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that's enough. Maybe that's enough as a character motivation. I personally, David Chen, I'm looking for a little bit more than that, but
you want some nuance,
it.
You know?
Yeah, I want some nuance. A word we have not used in this podcast 18 times. All right. Any other thoughts on this episode? We should say that Durin's dad sends Durin to go to Lindon and like figure out what is happening, which I assume means like what's the forge being used for and why they're doing all this, etc. Right?
Yeah. I think overall, I think this was for me one of the stronger episodes. The Numenor stuff is strong from a visual perspective. I feel as though it's kind of the midpoint, like a means to an end, where we have to get Galadriel and company somewhere. I'm withholding judgment on it entirely until I see what happens with them in the Southlands if they go, and what happens in Numenor either during the end of the season or potentially in later seasons. I think the Moria Elrond plotline continues to be fairly strong for me.
Yeah,
I really like what Robert Aramayo is doing. Deeza continues to steal every scene that she's in. And I think overall, this is now that we are halfway through our 8-episode season one, I desperately wish that this was 12 episodes and that season two could start in the next 6 months. But alas, that is not the case.
All right. Well, those are some thoughts on season one, episode 4 of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. I want to say, if you're listening to this right now, either on YouTube or at Decoding TV or podcast.decodingtv.com, we appreciate it. Thanks for checking it out. We hope you've enjoyed the journey so far. We're halfway through. Can you believe it, Don Marshall?
No, amazing. No. I've spent 4 years hyping myself up for this, and now it's going to be over in a month. What the heck?
But thank you so much for listening. And if you enjoy the show, consider becoming a paid member at decodingtv.com. Or supporting Don Marshall on Patreon. We'll see you next week for another Decoding TV recap of The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. He is Don Marshall. I am David Chen. Goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.